Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
This is Daniel Parkinson with your next edition of Gay Mormon Stories. Today, I have the great privilege of interviewing Matt Salmon. Matt Salmon is an amazing person that I don't know that well, but I've seen him interview on Anderson Cooper for dropping names here. He was invited to that interview because his father is a congressman, and he was talking about being the gay son of a congressman. But Matt's also got plenty of his own qualities to recommend him for as a role model for young gay Mormons. And we're going to talk about that. And Matt, could you just give me a two-sentence introduction of yourself?
Yeah. I am in my final year of medical school. My plan is to go into adolescent psychiatry once I finish. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and have two pups right here with me right now.
Yeah, they might pitch in a little as part of the interview.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we'll hear from them. Hopefully they'll say something interesting. Okay, Matt. So, you know, this is a biographical interview, and so I just really want to go through your life timeline and, to start with, ask you about your Mormon heritage. You're from Arizona, right? So does your heritage go way back? What's the background of your family?
I think both sides of the family go back a few generations into Mormonism. I think on one side we had some members of the Scottish Guard that baptized and left Scotland and came to America. This was maybe four generations ago, or no, probably five. On the other, some of my ancestors came down and helped to settle some of the Mexican colonies that they have down in northern Mexico, southern Arizona.
Oh, really? So you and me are cousins then?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Which families are you from?
That would be the Hewish family.
I'm a Pratt.
Okay.
And, you know, another cousin of ours is Mitt Romney. I'm sure we're related. Everybody down there
yeah.
was related. Are you cousins with Mitt Romney?
Not that I know of. It could be very distant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if you are, if you have ancestors from the colonies. But anyway. Okay, so you were born into a Mormon family. What is your birth order?
I'm the last of four.
Okay. Brothers, sisters, older than you?
I have two sisters and a brother.
Okay. Well, so did you go up in Phoenix or in a smaller town?
Grew up in Mesa, which is a suburb outside of Phoenix.
Okay. But Mesa, if I'm not mistaken, is the most Mormon saturated part of that metro area. Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So, is there anything about your childhood that is you might want to tell us about your Mormon upbringing? Is there anything particularly unusual or normal about it? That
I think it was a pretty typical typical Mormon upbringing. I mean, we went to church every Sunday. We had scripture study every morning before school. I don't know. I guess the only thing odd about it was that my dad was in D.C. most of the time, so we would do scripture study over the speakerphone every morning so that he could be a part of it.
So your dad was a congressman even when you were very young.
Yeah, he's been in politics since I was three.
And he's been a congressman the whole time.
No, he was a congressman for 6 years, and he retired and was out of Congress for about 12, and just went back this last term.
So, but those 6 years was when he was in D.C., or even after he was a congressman, he stayed in D.C. periodically? Or...
No, after he was a congressman, he came back. He ran for governor of Arizona, and after that, that was against Janet Napolitano, who won. And after that, he more or less retired from being a politician and then was a lobbyist. And he moved to DC for a few years in there with my mom, and then came back a few years ago and decided to get back into politics.
Meanwhile, most of the time he went to DC, and you and your siblings and your mother stayed in Arizona while he was away.
Yeah, my dad commuted back and forth. He would leave Monday morning, come home Friday night.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So he was really a presence in your childhood then?
Yes.
Okay. So how about a lot of gay people as children, you know, have, you know, characteristics that make their family suspect. Some of them are, you know, not as fully gender conforming as the other little boys. How would you describe yourself as a child? Were you more of a rough and tumble kid, or were you more sensitive, or?
I think I was a little of both. I was a pretty good mix, I'd say. I mean, I love to go out and I love to play sports, and I love to play in the mud and dirt and play with bugs and stuff. I don't know. As far as other than that, I mean, I had mostly girlfriends though, so I had a lot of girls, which kind of mellowed me out, I guess, and added more to that sensitive side.
But was anyone concerned or raising eyebrows or anything when you were in your childhood?
I think my mom only had a concern that I played with girls too much. That was her only big concern.
Well, then how about your adolescence? Most adolescents, that's when things start getting confusing for most everybody.
Well,
can you describe?
I mean, I remember back from before I was a teenager already knowing that something was different. I didn't really know what the word was for it until I was probably 12 or so. But I knew before that that there was something different about me. So in adolescence, I was very aware of what was happening or what was different about me at that point. I knew that I was gay, and that was probably more so it was learning about it from bullies, because it was at that point that I realized what it was when they started calling me names.
How old were you when the bullying started?
I was in probably fifth or sixth grade, so I was probably 11. Uh-huh. Maybe 10. I don't know.
Uh-huh. And so when you say you thought something was different about you, was it the bullying that sort of brought that out in your view? Or
I can remember back when I was about 7 or 8, feeling different and liking my friends that were boys. But it wasn't, I didn't realize it was a problem until I started to be bullied about it.
You were bullied about liking guys? Did people know?
No, they didn't know. But I mean, just as all kids are, or like, I mean, it happens everywhere. They like to put each other down. So, I mean, they would call me names, not knowing, but they just assumed and they figured it out, even though I tried to hide it.
Yeah. How would you rate the bullying? Was this a huge, you know, trauma for you at the time, or was it sort of just once in a while? I mean, what's on the scale of bullying?
With certain groups of people, it was pretty bad. If I stuck to my own groups and avoided those, then I was fine. But no, I often went home from school crying.
So was your church experience a refuge from this, or was it going on there too in those years?
With my ward was great. The people, like, no, we were pretty cohesive. At least I wasn't bullied in my ward. I know that there were some that were bullied in the ward, but I wasn't one of them. Outside of the ward in my stake, though, it was stake members that were the ones, like I said, that I had to avoid because they were the big bullies.
Yeah. So the combination of this and kind of being aware of your interest in boys, at some point it clicked to you then that this was because you were gay.
Yes.
Did this come out of partly out of being exposed in the media or in the internet to what it meant to be gay? Did you already have a term or a basic understanding of what that term meant by the time you were a young teen?
I think I started to understand it around when I was, when I was being bullied about it. And I can't remember exactly, but I probably asked somebody what it meant but I was probably called the name first and then asked somebody what it meant.
And when you found out what it meant, did you say to yourself, yeah, that's true, I am? Or, I mean, how did that evolve at the time?
Oh, well, at that point, I had already known, I just didn't know there was a word for it. I knew that what they were saying was true, but I tried really hard to avoid it because at that point, I knew that it was going to be a lot of heartache if it came out. Yeah.
Okay, so can you, I know it's hard to kind of recall what perspectives you had at the time, but I'm trying to, you know, imagine what an experience would be like, because I wasn't aware at age 12, but what it was like, what did that mean? If you knew you were gay, what did that exactly did that mean to you? Like, can you kind of think how you might have defined it, or what it was that made you perceive you were gay? Was it, would you think about kissing a guy, or would you think about, you know, having crushes on guys, or what kind of exactly was it that?
Yeah, I had crushes on guys. I mean, I didn't, at that point, at that age, I wasn't really thinking about getting physical, but I definitely had interest in the boys, and I mean, they intimidated me, and but they excited me at the same time.
Was this, you know, accompanied then, obviously the bullying was going to cause you shame. Were you also getting shame in the context of your church about that? Were you having, I mean, all teenagers, every teenager, gay or straight, goes through a lot of shame, you know, about their sexuality.
Yeah.
But did this affect you particularly in the context of having this awareness that, yes, you were gay?
Oh, yeah. I was an incredibly guilty kid. I confessed pretty much everything, including thoughts that I had, because I was afraid that, I mean, the thoughts were going to send me to hell or whatever it might be. So I did a lot of confessing, so much so that my mom had to ask me to stop telling her everything because it was excessive.
Really? So you were mainly confessing to your mother, or were you also confessing to your bishop?
I was confessing things to my mother in the hopes that she would help me figure out what things needed to be confessed to the bishop.
I see.
And mostly none of them needed to be confessed to the bishop. It was just me having an acute sense of guilt.
Yeah. Well, part of that sounds actually lovely that you're, you know, I'm not sure how progressive your mother was on the issue, but just the fact that you were able to be open with her, I mean, it sounds like a better starting point than...
Oh, yeah, I told her everything. I mean, which is why I came out to her when I was so young.
So you actually came out to her literally at 12 or 13?
I told her when I was 14, because that was when I finally got the courage to actually vocalize it. I mean, it took me a while before I'd even write the words in my journal. I would always kind of skirt around it when I was writing to myself in my journal, because I thought that if I wrote it, it solidified it.
I see. And how was her initial reaction?
Well, it was Christmas, and it was when she came in to say goodnight to me. She would tuck me in every night. She came to tuck me in and say goodnight. And I just told her that I was attracted to guys. And she said it was curiosity, and that it was a phase, and that it would just pass. And so that's just kind of how I hoped and prayed that that was true. And... I mean, it didn't take long for me to realize that it wasn't, but I had hoped for it to be.
So initially, both you and her were sort of hoping this was going to not be a lifelong problem.
Yeah, we had hoped it would just be transient.
Uh-huh. And so did she let your father know right away, or other family members, or did...
No, actually...
You and her for a while.
She kept it between me and her. We didn't really talk about it again, but she kept it between me and her. And then when I was... probably 15 or 16, I told my dad.
In the meantime, you can certainly feel free to, we can skip this part, but, you know, a lot, it's pretty ubiquitous that teens also have issues with masturbation and porn, and that adds to a lot of guilt that when someone's gay, they're taught that this is what's making them gay, or at least in my generation, they were.
I went to family counselor, the church family services, actually, for therapy on my issue with masturbation.
Because you had told your bishop about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I confessed to him pretty much every time I did it.
Really? Okay. So from age 13 or...
I think I started when I was like 11. I started before I even knew what it was. And I learned what it was through the For the Strength of the Youth pamphlet.
Okay. And that's when you found out that you shouldn't be doing it, basically. Was
yes, because I had been doing it, and I got, when I turned 12, I got the For the Strength of the Youth pamphlet, and I was reading through it, and I said, and it said that masturbation was wrong, and I thought, what is that? I don't know what that is. And so I asked my mom, and she explained to me what it was, and I thought, oh, I've been doing that for the last 6 months, so I guess I should stop.
So you were even able to say that to your mom?
I don't think, at that moment, I don't think I had said so to my mom, but I told her later.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then you started talking to your bishop about the masturbation.
Yes. Once I knew I should feel guilt for it, I started to feel the guilt for it. But until then, I didn't have any issue. It was great.
And your bishop sent you to counseling about the masturbation.
Yes, because I had, I mean, mine just wouldn't stop. I can, I, so I, because I.
You and everybody.
I know, but for whatever reason, I don't know why. Like, I've talked to, like, peers of mine since being in there, and they all, I mean, they all did it too, but I don't know why I felt this incredible sense of shame, and they're like, whatever, like, it was normal, and I had this huge issue.
Yeah. Were you, did you also, I'm assuming internet porn was already, so was it sort of widely available back then?
I don't remember when that started. Probably, I think when I was in junior high that started.
But was that part of what you were going to counseling about?
Yeah, because I think it was, I mean, it wasn't until I was a teenager. I think I was probably 16 by the time I started going to it, because I think I could drive myself. So, yeah, it was, I mean, that was part of it, was the porn and the masturbation. But I look back and I don't think I ever even told the counselor that it was gay porn. I think I just told him, I let him just assume whatever he wanted.
Okay. And the same with your bishop. You didn't actually tell him that element of it, that it was gay porn?
No, the bishop knew.
He did know. Okay.
Yes. I think I had three bishops throughout my adolescence, and each one of them knew. Actually, from the moment I figured it out, pretty much, or the moment at least, when I, from being a teenager on, I told every bishop I ever had.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's, in a way, that's extraordinary, because I think that most youth kind of are better at denial, or better at, what do you call it, rationalizing, or whatever you would call it, healthy rationalizing, maybe, but...
I wish I could have figured something healthy out to do for it, but...
So, what's your feeling about how the counseling was overall for you? Did it end up being a positive, negative?
Well, that counseling at the time, the family services for masturbation, I mean, it didn't really do anything. And so, I don't really remember... I just remember feeling uncomfortable all the time. Like, why does this guy want to talk to me about jerking off? Like, it was just strange.
But it was a treatment model with an idea that you would stop masturbating?
I guess. Like, I don't even remember what the therapy sessions were like. I think I probably journaled or things, I imagine. But I know if you want to get into it now, like, my reparative therapy, had a good impact on me. Or and I had a significant impact on me, I suppose.
Well, let's talk. I do want to talk about that. How old were you when you entered reparative therapy, though?
I was 18.
Okay. Well, let's just talk about other aspects of your adolescence first.
Okay.
I mean, meanwhile, you know, this was going on in the background. How was your adolescence experience otherwise? Your church experience, your school experience?
I mean, it was great. I was an overachiever. I mean, in church and in school. I think I became president of every quorum I was in. I mean, I was constantly reading the Book of Mormon and some other book. I couldn't fall asleep at night unless I had read scripture and prayed for a substantial amount of time. I think in total, I probably read the Book of Mormon in my adolescence 7 times or so, and read every other book at least once.
So you were way more oriented towards the church than probably most of your peers, right?
Yes, I was. And I think part of that was just me trying to do everything I could to do everything right so that God would find some kind of justification for making me straight.
So what you see now is that your reason for being so hyper-religious as a youth was really that you were trying to sort of earn God's forgiveness and hope for change.
I was trying to earn a miracle here. I don't think I was ever once asked to speak, but I asked 3 or 4 times if I could speak. And so every time that I spoke in church was me asking the bishop if he would let me.
Really?
Yeah, I was that kid.
Yeah. Wow. Was the church still, you know, for you a social refuge? Did you have a fun youth group? Were your friends the ones at church?
Yeah, I had several friends at church, and we had a lot of fun. I mean, we had a great time on scout outings and just anything we did. The youth group, I thought, was incredible. I was really happy with the youth group that we had.
And so, really, in a lot of ways, church was a real positive experience for you then.
It was. I would say church, as in the social aspect of it, was the positive. It was, well, inside my ward was positive. But as far as church for my emotional well-being, it was not good. It was very detrimental.
Were you getting periods of depression? I mean, was it spilling over into your overall mental health?
It really didn't become. I actually never really had issues with depression until I got into high school, and then that's when it really started to weigh on me. Oh yeah, I was terrified in my adolescence. I mean, as a kid, that I was going to end up in hell. But for me, I would have been fine with hell could I have my family with me. Though, to me, what hell was eternity without my family. But that's why I felt terrified, was because I knew that my family would go to heaven and I might not, or they would go to the celestial kingdom and I might not.
Yeah.
And that was my huge fear. That was where all of my sadness came from.
And you totally believed that.
Oh, yes. I don't know how many times or how many hours I spent on my knees through my childhood, my adolescence, praying and asking God. And often my prayer was just God was first to make me straight. And if not, because I will not make it to the celestial kingdom, at least don't make me be alone. And I would pray and ask, please, if I can't be in the celestial kingdom, at least let me have my family. But in my heart, I knew that they would go to the celestial kingdom and I wouldn't.
Yeah. You weren't feeling cast out immediately, but you were feeling an eternity of being cast out is what you were seeing.
Yes. Because of what I had been taught.
Yeah. In high school, then, this really emerged as a depression. You were getting the... Were you in treatment for it? Were you...
When I say high school, it was actually more my senior year, and that actually had more to do with a relationship I had with a boy.
Okay, well, let's come to that then. That's really important. But I just want to tie up the earlier years then, most of your high school. It sounds like in school you were super academically pushed in the same way that you were at church.
I was. It was pretty much like through high school. Up until like the end of my senior year, I was
involved in all the extracurricular activities.
Yeah, I did athletics, I did music, I did theater, I was a student ambassador. I even did speech and debate for a little bit.
Okay, so you were really involved. Would you say that socially things got better as you got older? Were you able to sort of diffuse the bullying a little bit, or did that just continue?
I just got better at avoiding it. There were still the same kids that were bullying me in 5th and 6th grade bullied me because we went to the same junior high and we went to the same high school. They bullied me all the way up until senior year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, how many times can we beat a dead horse?
Yeah. So that was just this prolonged sort of also background noise that was just sort of adding up, right?
Yes. Other.
So I'm not surprised that would have an impact on your mental health. So then tell me, so it sounds like there was a big event in your senior year.
Well, actually, I mean, part of the senior year, before I entered high school even, I mean, not this is not part of senior, part of high school. Before I entered high school, I had an experience with another boy, which he then proceeded to share with other people. And that's why high school was even a little more stressful, is because now people had this proof, even though I denied it at every turn and I asked him to stop sharing it with people as it was my piece and not his.
What was his motivation for sharing it? Was he just didn't care, or was
no, he didn't care. He was being spiteful. I mean, by that point he had come out and he was he claims it was part of his coming out experience, and so he had to share my name. I denied it right and left, but didn't work so well.
Yeah. So that contributed to the bullying and some of the ostracization at school. Did it also complicate things at church?
Not really. I don't think, because none of the people in my ward really were friends with this guy anyway, so they didn't really, it didn't trickle really down to them. But yeah, in high school, like different people at school and stuff like that.
Yeah. This group of bullies in particular, did they get wind of that rumor too?
I don't know if they ever did, actually. They never said anything about it.
Okay. But it must have just made you even more terrified, right? That this was just...
Yes, because I heard it from multiple people. And luckily, the people that were talking about it were actually progressive and open-minded, and they weren't using it as ammo to bully me, but it still terrified me that people knew.
Right, because it wasn't on your terms in any way at all.
No, it wasn't.
Okay, and then you referred to something that happened your senior year then that also sort of...
Yeah, and that was actually a catalyst for my reparative therapy as well. My senior year, I met a guy and really liked him, fell for him. We went out for a little bit before my good Mormon guilt kicked in and I realized that if I didn't straighten up my act, I was going to be damned for eternity. So I ceased with that. I broke up with him, essentially. I told him that we couldn't do this because I wanted to do everything that I could to go on a mission and do the right thing. So I ended that with him. I went and talked to my bishop and told him about it and told him at that point that I would just be alone forever and would never pursue another relationship because I knew that I couldn't be with a woman. Just because of who I was and that I couldn't be with a man because of the church I belonged to. So I would be forever alone. And I told him that I wanted to prepare to go on a mission. And so it was about a year and a half probably before I would have gone on a mission. And I told him that I wanted to prepare and that I wanted to talk to the stake president so that he could be aware of what was going on so that there would be no holdups when it came time to go. And he said, you know, I don't think that's necessary. I think we can handle it just us. And I was persistent. And so he got me an appointment with the stake president. And I sat with him. And he requested that I confess every sin that I had ever committed. And so, I mean, the scripture, and I will remember them no more, really didn't matter at this point. I was to confess everything that I'd already repented of and relive it all again. And so... I confessed it all to him and relived my shame and told him about the most recent experience and felt nothing from him. To me, this was just some man. I didn't see any God behind the man. And after I left his office without really any kind of sense of what was going to happen, a few days later, I got a call from my mom saying, President Gulbranson called your dad. We need to talk about this. You need to come home. And so my stake president had called my father and explained to him my recent visit with him. And so that's how that all came out and told my parents. And so my parents were very upset. It was a huge deal because up until this point, though I was attracted to men, I wasn't acting on it. And so things were fine. But now that
because your father knew about the attraction. You had told him already about that.
Yeah, he knew.
Okay. But the stake president really divulged your confidence by telling him what you told him in your interview. He had totally breached your confidentiality.
Yes, he did. I then kind of had to rehash with my parents. And it was at that point that my parents were involved at the time well, my mom was the president of United Families International in Arizona, which was a group, very keen on anti-gay politics. And she had come in contact with a therapist who did reparative therapy. And so she said, hey, I know this therapist. If you would like to do this, this is something to consider. And I wanted to do it because I wanted to change I had for years, and nothing else worked, so I figured I would try it.
Yeah.
So it was, yes, during the that was the end of my senior year, and so I went into major depression my last semester of high school, and my grades fell, and I mean, luckily, I mean, they were high enough to begin with that it didn't really harm me too bad, but they still dropped at that point.
So it kind of ended high school on a bad note.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of reparative therapy then? You were going to an individual therapist. Was it it wasn't through the church though, or?
No, I mean, he was a church member, but it wasn't church sponsored. And my stake president was adamantly opposed to it the entire time.
He was opposed to the reparative therapy?
Yes.
Why?
Because, at least from what I understand, in his experience, it was just a venue for a bunch of gay kids to get together, and that didn't seem healthy and safe.
So he was worried by participating in, because there was group therapies too?
Yeah, I went to individual, I went to group, I went to camps.
What's the name of the program? Is that one of the ones we might have heard of?
Oh, what is it? They're called Family Strategies. It's one in Mesa.
Is it still there?
I have no idea. My dad told me that he's heard rumor that my therapist left his wife and left the church. So I don't know if that's true or what. I haven't had it confirmed, but he said that's what he heard.
Okay, so your stake president was against this because he had this belief that if gay people meet each other, they might hook up, which...
Yeah, which, I mean, that's...
probably true.
Yeah.
Anyway, you continued for a year and a half, so you also did it into your freshman year of college.
Yes, I did.
Where did you go study?
I studied at ASU.
So you were still living at home, and you were doing the reparative therapy. Tell me about the reparative therapy. Did you get anything good out of it? Did you...
Oh, yeah.
Decrease the isolation? I mean, tell me what the experience was like. Did you look forward to the group meetings? I mean...
I enjoyed them, actually, because we had a lot of... Like, I became friends with several of them, and so we kind of just would just have a lot of fun and mess around. But I gleaned a lot from it, actually. When I was young, I had a lot of, like, body dysmorphic issues that we worked on in therapy. I had some major self-esteem issues that we worked on in therapy. I struggled to make friends with guys and talk to guys because I was always intimidated. We worked on that in therapy. So really, I mean, it made me into a more effective gay, is what I explained to people, because I became better at flirting, became better at approaching men. I also became more comfortable with my own body and felt more comfortable in my own naked skin. So, I mean, essentially it made me into a better gay. So I'm happy with it.
Because when I think about reparative therapy, I mean, there is harm and there's potential for harm, right?
Yes.
The harm being that you're paying for a promise that cannot be delivered.
Well, my insurance paid for most of it.
Yeah. But you were investing time, you were investing...
Yes, I was.
You were investing this wish, this fantasy, this your eternal salvation, you know, all on this idea that they were going to cure you. And they were telling you a lie that they could.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a terrible premise to start anything with, right?
It was. And then, I mean, there is harm in that. And I realize that. But I just count my blessings that I am the personality that could take something positive from it. I know that not everybody would be able to. And I mean, in other people's experience, it would be incredibly harmful. But,
I also want to have a nuanced view of it, that I agree with you that if you have a good therapist and if it's providing you certain things that you weren't going to get anywhere else, I mean, it could almost be life-saving. Because if you're so isolated and this just finally gives you a chance to connect some people and you don't feel so alone in the world, to me that seems like a big advantage. And also if it gave you these social skills that you needed, and if this therapy wasn't too oriented about shaming you and stuff, I do think it's highly possible that someone, you know, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. I would recommend an affirming therapy. But I just want to, you know, admit that there's probably some people that do get some benefit out of these kind of therapies or these kind of groups, or at least it sounds like you did.
And the thing is, I mean, Yeah, I could have gotten the same thing from a therapist who wasn't trying to make me straight, but that was the therapy I could get at the time. And I mean, I needed a lot of therapy. Like you said, and my therapist was great. Though he was Mormon, he wasn't really churchy. He didn't bring religion into it. He actually was the one that helped me to lose my shame over masturbation and was just like, everybody does it. Like, you need to just don't feel shame about this because everybody does. And he helped. It was finally at that point that I realized that I was really pretty normal. I mean, yeah, they were still trying to change this thing about me, but for the most part, like, the therapy was good aside from the exercises in claiming my straighthood.
Right. Were there sort of role models within that organization of working there who had overcome gay and were get married and that kind of thing?
Well, my therapist was gay and he became straight.
Okay.
I laugh because, I mean, if, like he even told me that it was a daily struggle, that he daily had to like retrain his brain to be attracted to his wife.
Yeah.
Like it was that is not what I call success.
Right. Do you think you were able to give that a perspective at the time? Were you able to say, well, look, he's this so-called success, and this is what it means. Did that, in the long run, sort of say, maybe I don't really want to try to go there?
That was a big part of why I left in the end. It's because I realized that, I mean, if I was going to go down this path of trying to be with women, I realized that no matter what, I was always going to like men. I was just going to have to like swallow it and get, I don't know, just it was like a daily dose of medicine, essentially. And I realized there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need to do this. It seems that it was excessive and it was unnecessary. And I think it is in that you find most of the harm. As far as like my therapy, I didn't find a lot of harm there, but in telling me that I'm gonna have to like deal with this for the rest of my life and just be in pain for the rest of my life and struggle, that's where the harm is. And I think that's where you see a lot of people have issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's pretty compelling that your greatest fear about the whole thing was being alone. And all this was reinforcing for you was that you needed to be alone, or that this is what God wanted for you, to be alone or something.
Yeah.
And so it does seem like someone who's being afraid of being alone eternally might also not want to be alone throughout this life, right?
Yeah, that is very true.
Okay, so what was your decision about the mission then?
So, when that all came down to it, I went and saw my bishop and stake president regularly. They tried to persuade me to do a service mission, which, I mean, for me, it was just seemed like Mormon social suicide. I mean, at least, like the way I see it, at least the guys who didn't go on missions were badasses, and the ones that did were the honorable ones, but those that went on service missions just seemed like they were trying too hard.
Okay.
I don't know, you can cut that out if you want
Frankly,
to.
I mean, I like the answer. You can decide later, but
I'm fine with it, but
okay.
no.
No, I mean these perceptions that you get are these are this is important. We're part of a society. We're not just. I mean, you were super motivated by your conscience and by your religious beliefs, but none of us is also removed from the community where we live. And I tell you. You know, perfectly honestly, that I went on a mission because I didn't want to be socially ostracized either. I wanted to partake in my community. I wanted to be able to, at the time, I thought I wanted to get married, and I knew that I wouldn't have very many choices in Mormonism if I didn't go on a mission. So those aren't the best reasons to go on a mission, but I totally get it if
Oh, yeah. I
you
mean,
would see that as a social suicide to do a service mission, even though at this point, from this perspective, I'd rather go on a service mission. But I can see that having that
yeah.
viewpoint at age 19.
Well, I mean, being raised, like, I was raised that boys do two things when they grow up. They go on an honorable mission, or Mormon boys do two things. They get raised and go on an honorable full-time mission. And then they get married afterwards, and girls are raised to do two things. They're raised to marry a boy who went on an honorable full-time mission and then have children afterwards. And
Yeah.
I mean, like, at that point, I didn't see myself being with a girl anyway. But I knew that in order to really fit in, I would have to go on a mission. And I actually really wanted to. I wanted to do the work. I mean, I did all the legwork. Like I said, I studied so much when I was a kid. I wanted it to actually mean something, all of the studying that I had done. So I went and I saw my bishop and stake president, and I knew the gospel incredibly well. I mean, when I graduated high school, they called me to be a teacher, and I was teaching Sunday school for investigators. And I don't know, like, it would always fall on me to teach the lesson. If, like, one of the other teachers couldn't do it, they would call me rather than call one of the other teachers, because they always enjoyed the way I taught. And I think I had a fresh perspective. But,
and so you were more qualified than almost anybody to actually do what it took to be a missionary.
I was. I was teaching the investigators when they would come to church. And I was.
How many 19-year-olds have done that, right?
No, I was 18 at that time. So, I know. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, even the greenies or whatever, when they turn 19, they aren't really teaching. So I thought that I was well prepared. I hadn't really had issue since then. My issue with the one boy when I was a senior in high school. So I thought that I was well prepared. I got all of my paperwork done. I got all my vaccinations done. I did my physical. I did all of my paperwork. All that was left to be done was for my stake president. My bishop signed off. All that was left was for my stake president to sign off. And I went and I met with him. And this is over a year later. And from everything I'd ever taught, sexual sin, you had to repent for a year before you could actively do some service, whether it be a mission or get sealed in the temple, all of that stuff. It all revolved around 1 year of abstinence and of being clean. And I had. And so I went to him and I asked him to sign and forward my paperwork. And he looked at me, and after all this time, after all this meeting, he said, "You know, I can sign this, but I'm going to tell you they're going to reject it." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, okay, never mind." And I left his office and I never turned in my paperwork. I decided that, I mean, I wasn't going to turn in my paperwork only to tell all of my family that my call should arrive in 6 weeks or whenever, only to be rejected. And have to then tell them all about that. So I just decided that I would not even try. At that point, I gave up, and I didn't really look back. I decided to dive into my education. I got my undergrad in 3 years, and now I'm in med school. So I'm happy with the path that I've taken.
Well, so it did get you on the fast track with your education, but that must have really, you know, required a huge shift in your outlook on life, at least, you know, after your whole life of looking towards a mission, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a huge deal. It was a huge deal with my family because we were raised to go on missions. And, I mean, it became a big deal socially within the church. I mean, I was in a university ward, and I was just when I was at ASU, I was going to the university ward. I think I was 20 by this point. This was around the time that I stopped going to church. But I was there, and this bishop's wife came up to me, and she was just talking and said, "Oh, where did you go on a mission?" And I said, "I haven't gone on a mission." And she kind of got excited, and she said, "Oh, great. So when are you going to go?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm 20, and I'm not going on a mission." And her face just kind of dropped, and she didn't say another word, and she turned around and walked away. And then that was kind of the way that things went. From that point, nobody knew how to deal with the 20-year-old boy who was not on a mission.
Right. You went from being the precocious person who was teaching the investigators and was a standout, was all the quorum presidents all your life, and all of a sudden you were fallen from grace, apparently.
Yes.
Without them even knowing why, just simply for the fact of not having gone on a mission.
Yep. That was all.
Yeah. So how about your family? Did your mom and dad basically know that the reason you didn't put in your papers was because they had decided to make you wait 3 years instead of one?
They never even talked about a 3-year thing. They just said, they told me that I would be rejected.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even that you could have waited 2 more years and still gone. Okay.
No, that wasn't really an option for me. My parents, I think only recently did they learn that, that was the issue. And my parents for the longest time thought that I just decided that I didn't want to do it.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was actually, there was some contention there because they thought that it was just because of, I just decided.
Right. Well, that would have been discouraging. Tell me again, you told me at the beginning, but you have 2 brothers and a sister?
I have 2 sisters and a brother.
Okay. And your brother went on a mission, I assume?
Yes, he went to Brazil.
Okay. And did any of your sisters, or they got married, or?
My one sister married her high school sweetheart when he got back from his mission. She did not go on a mission. And they've been happily married ever since, have 4 kids. Then my other sister, she did serve a mission. She actually just returned last May. She went when she was 25, and okay. Yeah, she just got back last year.
I'm trying to sort of put a date to this. How old are you now?
25.
You're 25. So this was about 5 years ago.
Yes.
Okay. So at that point in time, your one brother had gone on a mission. So
yes.
How long did you stay active in the church then?
It was when I was 20 that I really kind of stopped being active, and that was around Prop 8. I had been going. I lived with a group of 3 gay Mormons. We lived together, and we'd go to church together.
Guys you met at the therapy, basically.
No. One of them I knew from high school, and the other one, the one I knew from high school, knew him because they knew each other from their missions or something like that.
Okay.
So I lived with those two. I mean, talk about like a sitcom, 3 gay Mormons living in a house. But we would go to church, and around Prop 8, we had a stake high priesthood leader come and take the pulpit, and he preached about how we needed to send our money to Prop 8 and how we needed to lobby our relatives living in California and our friends to vote for Prop 8. And he told us that the reasoning behind it was that really gay people are selfish in their desire for marriage because all they want to do is to steal rights, and they're doing it just for themselves and just to benefit them. Whereas heterosexual couples are completely selfless because they get married for the betterment of the community and for the children that they will have and for each other, and they don't do it for themselves.
Yeah.
And my friend and I looked at each other, and we left after that meeting, and we pretty much never went back.
Well, so that was, that's been 5 years now, right? But anyway, that was your moment of really realizing that you weren't getting truth at church. Is that how it hit you? Or was it a hostility that you were feeling? Or what was it about that really, it just felt like a direct attack?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just a huge turnoff. And at that point, I realized that this wasn't where I wanted to be. I didn't want to add my name in support of a group that was going to be so negative. But it wasn't until a couple of years later that I resigned.
Uh-huh. But in the meantime, when did you start deciding to live a life as an openly gay person?
That was when I was 20. It was before, so this was spring. Prop 8 happened in November. It was spring of that same year. Actually, it was around the time that I stopped going to reparative therapy. I mean, it was a big time. It was around the time that I stopped going to reparative therapy, I believe. And at the tail end of my reparative therapy, I had a girlfriend, and she, because I was following the exercises that they told me to do. So I dated this girl, and she ended up breaking up with me because she had gone to conference, and the spirit told her that we shouldn't be together, but she didn't know why. And I, as she's breaking up with me, I thought, well, I mean, I know why it's telling you not to, but she had no idea that I was gay until I told her a couple of years later.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, I told her, that's why the spirit told you not to date me. But So after we broke up, and I stopped going to reparative therapy, I started to realize that nothing was wrong with me and that I was great just the way that I was. And I knelt down and I decided that I was finally going to resolve this issue that I had had with God. I realized that all my life I'd been praying and asking for God to make me straight when that wasn't how my parents raised me. My parents raised me teaching me that I should come to God with a question. And actually, I should come to God with an answer. I should answer my own question. And then if God approved of my answer, I would know. Or if he disproved, I would know. So they always taught me, and they taught me as well, that sometimes God just doesn't care. Like, you can, either decision is not going to be a big deal. But I decided I'm no longer going to ask God to take this away from me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to make a decision, and I'm going to tell God that I've made a decision, and if he doesn't like it, he can tell me. And so I went and I prayed, and I said, Dear Heavenly Father, I know that I've asked you to take this away from me to make me straight, but now what I'm doing is I have come up with a decision. I've decided that it's okay to be gay, and I want you to tell me if that is the right decision. And at that moment, and for the first time in my life, I felt an incredible peace that I had never felt in my life before. And 20 years of guilt and shame melted away. And I felt, for the first time, a sense of self-love. And I knew at that point that it was okay for me to be gay. And it was actually the right path for me and the one that I should take. And so I never looked back. It was a great experience.
Well, you know, this is one of the most important messages that I think I want people to hear, because the Mormons have one thing right, and that's about hearing testimonies. And this is the exact testimony that so many people need, that they really need to do what you did, which is to go ask God. And you have to be willing to accept whatever answer he's going to give you. I mean, you kind of made your own decision, but you were also there being open to whatever he said. And that was the first time you were really being open to it.
Yeah.
Because before, you had only given him an ultimatum, take it away.
Yeah.
This time you had finally decided to let God actually give you an answer. And that is absolutely what we're taught to do in Mormonism.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was a pivotal moment for you.
It was a huge moment.
At that point, did you feel like you would be okay to step out of the church then, even though it took you a little while? It took Prop 8 to sort of move you out?
No, I mean, at that point, I still believed in the church. And it wasn't until Prop 8 really turned me off that I started to question my belief in the... I mean, well, no, I had questions all my life that people couldn't answer. But it wasn't until, but I was, I mean, I was satisfied with not having an answer, but it wasn't until Prop 8 really kind of irked me that I thought, you know, I should get answers. And I started to look, and people always say I must have looked at anti-Mormon literature, but I did no such thing. I looked at church record. I looked at old writings from the prophets. I looked at legal records of Joseph Smith's life and things like that, that really kind of opened my mind to what exactly I felt about the church and what I believed. And at that point, I decided that I didn't believe it any longer.
Well, I mean, it's pretty compelling that supposedly Mormons base their testimony on a spiritual confirmation.
Yes.
And in your entire life, the most important spiritual confirmation you had had was that it was okay with God that you were gay.
Yes.
So I can see how having Prop 8 would right there go against the only thing that you really knew, that the only confirmation you'd had was being directly contradicted by something the church was telling you.
Exactly.
So it's easy for me to believe that you would, you know, that that would provoke you to question if you were getting the truth at church.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again, at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons.
How gentle God's command. precepts are. Come cast your burdens on the Lord and trust His constant I'll drive.